1,541. And so it's a square that again became written as a sum of two other squares. So 4,000 years ago, already somebody was walking with this table, probably using it for length measurement. And I think this is one of the wonderful things of mathematics, that you are in such a long tradition. In some sense, that theorem has been in our public consciousness, if you wish, for more than 4,000 years. Now, there's a wonderful phrase I want to share with you, which is actually the title of a paper by a famous mathematical physicist, Eugene Wigner. And the title of the paper is The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And he starts the paper with a little anecdote. And the anecdote is about a mathematician who meets a shoe salesman. And the shoe salesman is complaining that he doesn't know how many shoes and which size he should store. And then the mathematician tells, well, it's very easy. There's a formula for this. It's called the Gaussian distribution. And he writes the formula, and this is the formula. And then the salesman says, what's this symbol over here? Well, it's the Greek letter pi. What does it stand for? Well, it's the ratio between the circumference of a circle and the diameter. And then the shoe salesman asks, what does a circle have to do with shoes? And it's a very deep question. In fact, for the mathematicians, it's even square root pi that appears here. So it's actually something that you really have to think about every time you see a pi or a sine or a cosine. If you see mathematical symbols, they appear again and again and again, and they're like extremely valuable tools that you can use sometimes in circumstances that you didn't even think about. Now, there are many jokes and anecdotes about mathematics and physics, and I must say, usually it's the mathematicians who are the butt of the joke. And I wouldn't dare to tell one here, but this is one favorite. It's coming actually from a field medalist, Alain Kohn. So it's he actually told the joke, and the joke is about a person who has to do his dirty laundry. You can already see it's the physicist. With a big bag of dirty laundry, he walks into the town looking for a place to do the laundry. Suddenly he sees a shop, says laundrette. Not only that, it says café, restaurant, hotel, you know. So he comes there, and of course the shop is run by a mathematician. You see big beard. And the physicist asks, can I do my dirty laundry here? He said, no, you cannot. But I see the sign here. No, 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 we only sell signs. And and that's the general impression that physicists have of mathematicians. You know, they have all these beautiful words, but can you actually get something done? Now, that's not fair, because if you go look at famous physicists in history, they usually are very positive about the influence of mathematics. Galileo has this beautiful image of the book of nature. So nature is a book that you have to read, but it's written in a language, and the language in which it's written is the language of mathematics. So in his own quote, the universe cannot be read until we have learned the language and become familiar with the characters in which it's written. It's written in mathematical languages, and the letters are, remember, this is the early 17th century, triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures. Now, these triangles and circles have been vastly generalized, but I think this feeling is still shared by many physicists. In fact, there's another quote from Feynman, famous physicist, of course, the 20th century, who is not known as a lover of abstract mathematics, but yet he has this beautiful phrase that for those who do not know mathematics, it's difficult to get across a real feeling as to the beauty, the deepest beauty of nature. If you want to learn about nature, you have to learn the language. There's another quote of him, which is that if all mathematics disappeared today, physics would be set back exactly 1 week. This usually was the end of the story, but then I met a mathematician who had a good answer, and that was the week that God created the world. So I think, so I would say 2-1 physics to mathematics. In fact, to give an example of this feeling of wanting to apply mathematics, that, I mean, you can do it in several ways, and sometimes nature has kind of secrets that are difficult to find. And let me give this story. So these are the Platonic solids. They are five figures. They are from the Greeks, and they were, of course, very important to them. They were, in some sense, the highest point of mathematics. And they knew at some point there were exactly five. You know, they are special because they are made of, for instance, all kind of similar figures. Now, These figures go down a long time. There have been these balls that you see on top have been found in Scotland. They're really big, they're like footballs, soccer balls, also 4,000 years ago. And in the time of the Greeks, they thought, well, we had these five figures, and that's very nice because there are four elements out of which everything is made. Like, for instance, Earth was made out of a cube. It's nice, you can kind of make a big staple out of it. Fire, you know, it's hot, you can burn, so it has to have sharp edges, so it's this tetrahedron. And then there's the fifth figure left over, and then Plato said something, well, this was quintessence, this is the fifth element out of which the universe, everything outside Earth, was made. In fact, it's only a suggestion, if you read Plato, and it's his followers that actually made this in kind of a fact. It's something that happens to theoretical physicists, I think. You come up with a nice idea, and it becomes kind of canonical. And if you go to art history, you can see this dodecahedron in many, many places. And it's always standing for kind of the metaphysical, the thing outside the physical realm. For instance, here, one by Leonardo. This is one of my favorites. This is actually a monk, an Italian monk, who was kind of the inventor of bookkeeping. But you see, he also has this little dodecahedron here to say that's a little bit more than just the yearly figures. And here, Dali, many places. In fact, there was a few years ago, this brief interval when actually the dodecahedron appeared on the cover of the journal Nature, when there was a brief time that some cosmologists might think that actually the whole universe had the shape of the dodecahedron, which really was perfect justification of Plato's idea. So it was already, from that point of view, it was a great... But then I want to show you another figure, which I think is telling something very different. This is one of my favorite pictures. It's a picture, perhaps you recognize it. It's a picture of one of these little robots that went to Mars. And you know, the robot looked at these few square meters of ground there, and millions of people through websites looked at this, and I looked at one of the websites, and there was some comments where somebody was saying, well, I was very disappointed by this picture, because it looked just like it could have come from Earth. I think it's a very significant moment, because in some sense here you can literally see that the space outside Earth is made out of the same material. And so there's no place of this dodecahedron. But if you go back to the early 17th century again, I want to famous case of Kepler. Kepler, of course, famous astronomer. He was really in love with these Platonic figures. Here you see some sketches he made in one of his earliest publications. He was 25. His kind of cosmology. And Kepler's cosmology, at that time, the universe was very simple. It was just the sun around which the six planets rotated. So Kepler thought 6 is 5 plus 1. So if I take my 5 Platonic solids and I put them together, you can do that, a small calculation, 120 different ways. And he found one in which the ratio between these shapes of the spheres gave the ratio of the orbits of the planets within 5%. So this was his theory of the universe. Of course, there were only the six planets that you have to explain, and so you needed to explain these six numbers, and these were his harmonies of the spheres. Now, there are many ways why this you might not like this theory. If anything, there are more than six planets, but of course, there are many more suns. But the nice thing is that actually this theory was kind of killed by Kepler himself. And because of what? Because of very careful observations. And he observed, and that's of course his first law, that planets do not move on a circle, which is the perfect shape, but on an ellipse, which is very imperfect. And in his diary, he writes that this moment when he discovers this, he's very disappointed, because he feels he carries a carriage full of manure into science. Because the perfect form of the circle is destroyed and is made into this ellipse, you know, it could have all arbitrary shape, somehow destroys the whole idea of a perfect theory of everything, say, for the cosmos. Now, only a few years later, of course, Newton discovered that there is a beautiful symmetry. There's, in fact, even a symmetry in rotations in four dimensions, in a secret way. And that all these different shapes, all these conics, are just slices of this. There's basically in one mathematical family. And so there's beautiful and perfect mathematics in the shapes of the orbits of the planets, but not in the ratio of the sizes of the planets, the orbits. So Kepler was kind of had the good idea, but he was looking at the wrong place. And I think that's a history that repeats itself many, many times. Now, I'm not going to kind of scare you with many equations in mathematics, but roughly they all look like this, like A equals B. Now, usually if you go to a talk, it's about either about A or it's about B. But today I basically want to talk about the little sign in between, the equal sign. And that's actually the most important part, I feel, of a mathematical equation. Because it's putting usually two different worlds together. In some sense, it's almost like the ideas can flow from A to B through the equal sign. It's also putting things in perspective. So among philosophers, this is sometimes used called the Clinton's principle. Because of the famous words of President Clinton, depends on what the meaning of is. You know, there was this episode. And so the meaning of the equal sign is actually a very deep philosophical point. Because what does it mean to equal two things? You know, it's usually means that you have made some kind of dictionary between two worlds. And the dictionary I'm going to make tonight is basically between physics and math and how we can relate the two. Now, the fact that we are kind of understanding the physical world in terms of mathematics is already amazing. But what is really amazing is that we have been able to carry this intuition, in some sense, to realms which are very far away from everyday life. So the very large and the very small. And these were basically the topics, the quantum world and the universe, that I will be talking about today. So I will start with somehow some ideas from roughly 100 years ago, which was a very exciting time between the interaction of physics and mathematics, just to kind of warm you up. And I want to start with some famous, of course, ingredient of the theory of relativity, namely that time should be viewed as the fourth dimension. Now, at this point, I should ask if anybody is afraid of extra dimensions, because they will appear in many, many ways. And so this is a little crash course. So here I carefully prepared a two-dimensional object for you, square. And you can ask, you know, what would be the three-dimensional analog? Well, you know, here is a cube, a little cube. Now, of course, it's not the three-dimensional, actual three-dimensional. It's two-dimensional. It's a screen. But, you know, even if I brought all the way from Amsterdam an actual physical cube, and I would have been rotating it before your eyes, you would still be watching the retina in your eye. So everything you see is two-dimensional. The third dimension, somehow, you build up in your brain. In fact, not by so much by stereographic viewing, but more by moving. If you move your head, the images change, and that change is reflected in the third dimension. So why not move this one step up? And so this is a cube in four dimensions, which is rotating, and I've just projected it. Now, I knew a colleague of mine, actually at New York University, a biophysicist, who for a full year, with stereoscopic vision, looked at these kind of four-dimensional objects, hoping that at some point something in his brain would say click, and he would see the fourth dimension. I think it's very courageous. You know, I think it's very similar to these experiments where you put on these glasses and the image gets inverted, right? So, it didn't work for him, but perhaps a year is too short. Perhaps we should need some volunteers who try much longer. So in some sense, really understanding the fourth dimension is very difficult. And so we have to somehow think of it a little bit more in terms of metaphors. Now, to put Einstein's idea in perspective, because I will be using it many times, let's assume the world is two-dimensional. So here are two particles in a two-dimensional world. And to visualize this idea of time or space-time, you should really see this as a movie. So, of course, this is a movie as it's in my computer. It's a set of images. Now, suppose you take these images and put them like photographs and make individual images and put them on a big pile. Then you get a pile that kind of grows in height. The height is now time. And if you look at an individual particle, you follow it through this kind of stack of images, you will see it will sweep out a line, a red and a green line here that are kind of twisting around each other. And these are the two particles moving in something that we call space-time. So space-time is kind of the collective of all the space and all the time of all these images once together. And you can see that in some sense the whole history of each particle is kind of lying before you. And this is really the part where modern physics takes place. Now, I won't say much about it, but you probably all know a little bit that if you do the theory of general relativity, that space-time is even becoming something which is kind of interactive. If you put something like heavy in space-time, then the space-time will wrap around, so it will get curvature. The curvature in space-time will be proportional to the mass of the object that you put there, and this curvature is to manifest itself as gravity. So space-time is also a curved manifold. It's a space that can have all kind of interesting properties, and moving in that curved space is something that relativists study. Now, so the large domain is really in terms of geometry, I would say, from a mathematical perspective. Geometry is really the language of general relativity, and Einstein's big dream was to formulate everything in terms of geometry. If you go to the quantum world, it's kind of slightly different. In a very small, you get things like this, processes that happen in particle accelerators, and that there's anything like beautiful mathematics hidden in these pictures is in some sense not obvious, I would say. And in fact, what happened if you go to the 1950s, 1960s, when all these first particle accelerators were built, it's actually a period when the interaction between physics and math stopped to a large extent. Mathematicians became much more introverted, studying their own subjects, kind of cleaning up their own subject, while physicists were really overwhelmed with experiments. And in some sense, the kind of all the beautiful things they had found earlier seemed to be kind of destroyed. In fact, at that time, in the 1960s, there was this theory called S-matrix theory, which was really viewed in some sense, in a crude way, particle physics as a black box. So particles come in, they come out, it's a black box, it cannot be opened. In some sense, there is no mathematical description of nature. That was almost, at that time, the theory. And in fact, there's this famous quote by Freeman Dyson, famous mathematical physicist. I'm acutely aware of the fact that the marriage between mathematics and physics, which was so enormously fruitful in past centuries, has recently ended in divorce. Now, these are kind of famous last words, because around that time, 1972, it's the birth of the Standard Model, in some sense the resurrection of this interaction between physics and mathematics. And he couldn't be more wrong, in some sense. But I think it's a sign of the times. And in fact, I would like to say that this box can be opened, and inside is a very small formula. And that's my way here, using very succinct mathematical notation, to write the Standard Model of elementary particles. And the beautiful thing is you could give a lecture of that Standard Model to a mathematician. And of course, even if they don't understand anything of the physics, all the objects you would use would make perfect sense to the mathematician. They would be curvatures, they would be spinners, they would be gauge fields. Everything has a perfect geometrical sense. Of course, this is not the way you learn the Standard Model in a physics course, and you get more something like this. But you see, on the other hand, you can also put, if you wish, the Standard Model on a t-shirt. Just the fact that you have these very small number of particles, and that you can describe physics in such great detail, with such big mathematical precision, is really wonderful. Of course, in some sense, if you look at this is the particle data book. It contains basically all the properties of all the particles. It's extremely thick book, like a telephone book from a big city. And in some sense, it's all kind of based on that very simple Lagrangian and the simple mathematics underlying it. So it's an extremely successful way of applying math to physics. Now, the kind of crucial role is that in order to understand this, you have to kind of build nature in terms of little pictures that, for instance, you have really elementary processes. So particles can either go through, or they can exchange one particle, or two, or three. And the rules, the mathematics of quantum mechanics, is that you compute amplitudes, the probabilities, for each of these processes. So you do it one by one. You kind of slice kind of nature in individual slices. And if you ask, what is the most unifying object behind all of this, I would say, and I think everybody agrees, it's the notion of symmetry. Basically going back again to Kepler. The symmetry beyond it. And let me explain this a little bit in something that's I think quite appropriate here in front of David to explain, which is the strong force, QCD. So if you have, for instance, a quark can have three colors, between quotation marks, of course. That means that you can think of a quark as a little arrow that's pointing in some three-dimensional space. And the direction in which it's pointing is basically its color, and that arrow can be rotated around. So there's a natural symmetry in the theory of quarks is that you say all these arrows can be rotated. So this might, you might think, might be the appropriate symmetry. They're all rotating in the same direction. It's kind of a communist model of symmetry. So, but actually, that's not how nature works. I think it's more kind of a Dutch model, where basically every arrow is free to do whatever he wants. And so there's an enormous symmetry group, namely rotations around each point, underlying the theory of, well, of the strong interaction, but in fact, of all the gauge fields that appear in the standard model. In some sense, you can think of waves in these little arrows as being the forces that carry these interactions. Now, if you want to translate these findings in physics into mathematics, I've done it here in a very simple way, kind of ABC, you can roughly distinguish three periods, I would say. The first period is kind of the classical period. The classical period is basically of going from A to B. And you go from A to B according to some trajectory. And in some sense, the whole rule of the game is to find the trajectory. For instance, in classical mechanics, it will be a straight line. So if you see what kind of mathematics came out of it, there's a very long period, basically starting in the 17th century, ending in the end of the 19th century. You have things like calculus, dynamical systems, chaos theory, which of course was born at the end of the 19th century. It all belongs to the kind of classical mechanics. Then if you move up, and you move up to quantum mechanics, a particle still wants to go from A to B, but the amazing thing in quantum mechanics, it doesn't go through a fixed path. In quantum mechanics, we have to sum over all possible probability, all possible trajectories. So there's this famous sum over histories in quantum mechanics. So this is already, from a mathematical perspective, quite a bizarre thing to do. You're not looking at a fixed path that the particle goes, but you consider all of them at the same time. Some of them more likely than others. And if you see what kind of mathematics happened, the many mathematical fields in the 20th century appeared. Analysis and operator algebra, for instance. Now, the third level, I would say, is when a particle starts at A and doesn't end at B, but at B and C. That is, it splits in two particles. That's actually even more bizarre. And that is typical what happens in particle physics. And this is what I would say is quantum field theory. And the kind of mathematics where you include the creation and annihilation of particles, I would say, is typically 21st century mathematics. Things that have been happening, say, the last 10, 20 years, but which are only now developing. Because there's an even more foreign concept today. But of course, it's a concept that's deeply ingrained in nature. It's the way how nature works. And in some sense, we shouldn't be surprised, given this notion of the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, that this also gives rise to beautiful mathematics. And I want to give you a few examples. Now, the first example is actually a very down-to-earth example, which is knot theory. Now, a knot, a mathematical knot, is not a knot that you tie in your lace. It's a knot which basically you have a piece of rope, it goes around, you tie a knot, and then you glue the two ends together. So you can never untie the knot again. And there's a very simple question, which is basically how many types of knots can you have? Like, you know, the knots that sailors make, a nice list, 20 or something. But in principle, mathematical knots, there are infinite different types of these knots. So you could imagine if there would be a telephone book with all the knots, infinite the number of pages, and, you know, this is how the first page would look like. They're very simple. So it starts with these very simple unknots, which is just a rope, and then you have one, the trefoil, and you go on and on and on and on. And in fact, there's a question, can you characterize these? Is there some way in which you, if you tie a knot in a rope, can I find where you are in the telephone book? And mathematicians try to study this, and they, the way they want to study this is what they call a knot invariant. That is to say, if you give me a knot, they want to compute some number that comes out of it. In fact, this dates back to the end of the 19th century, when some physicists, like Lord Kelvin's famous case, thought that the nucleus of an atom was somehow a knot that tied it together. I'm very happy that that's not the theory of the periodic system, because it would be extremely complicated. So, but finding these knot invariants, in principle there are infinitely many of them, is extremely hard. So basically, early 20th century, one of them was found, but we knew there were infinitely many, and only the other ones came into the picture when, in some sense, the ideas from quantum physics appeared. Now, to explain why quantum mechanics and quantum physics has something to do with the knots, I want to raise another question, which is a very elementary question, namely, why is every elementary particle exactly the same? So, for instance, you have electrons. If you, with a refactory making electrons, it would make perfect identical copies. Why is this? Why isn't that one electron a little heavier or the charge a little less? I think it's a very deep question. It's a deep question that's answered by modern physics. And the way I want to present this is go back in history, the famous telephone conversation that happened, I think, in 1940-41 between John Wheeler, famous physicist who unfortunately died this year, and his, at that time, graduate student, Feynman. And Feynman describes this telephone call in his Nobel lecture. And he says, well, Wheeler calls him in the middle of the night, asks him this question, why are all the electrons the same? He says, I know the answer, because there's only one electron in the whole universe. I don't know if, you, if your advisor calls you middle of the night on Saturday, you, how serious you should take it. So that's very interesting. But let me explain Wheeler's idea. So his idea was the following. Here is space and time. Time is moving upwards. Here is this single electron. But we're changing the rules. Not only is this electron going forward in time, but it's allowed to go backward in time. And forward again, and backward again, and forward, and backward, and forward, and making a big knot. Now suppose you were able to go out of the room, back in time, and enter again. Of course, we have an identical copy of yourself here, and very easy to make many copies of yourself. So this would be the trajectory along these new rules of the electron. And if you look, say, at the beginning, you have one. If you look in the middle, and you slice this knot, you have many little things coming up and down. So these are electrons, and the other ones going down would be going back in time, would be anti-electrons. And of course, they would have exactly the same properties, because it's the same particle. So according to Feynman, he immediately says, well, why aren't there as many electrons as positrons? Which is a very clever answer. But of course, these diagrams are now known as Feynman diagrams. So he, in fact, if you look at these notes of Feynman, where he first time, in some sense, tries to compute the mathematics, you can really see he's very carefully trying to send his particles back into time, you know, investigating this idea. In fact, now it's a famous ingredient in how we think about particles in quantum field theory. And not only can particles go up and down, they can do more complicated things. For instance, this Feynman diagram, this describes a particle decaying into other particles that then again are joined together and go back. So these are one of the funny things that can happen in the quantum regime. It just happens fast enough, it's allowed. And in fact, you can have this process, which is called a vacuum fluctuation, which is a particle and antiparticle appearing out of nowhere and then annihilating again. Or, if you wish, in kind of the extreme case of the idea of Wheeler, a particle going up in time and down in time and up and down again. So this is called a vacuum graph. And these are very important in quantum field theory. The fact that you really can think of this as a particle going up and down. And now you can imagine that you can send this particle not along a circle, but along a knot. And this is the idea that happened in the end of the 80s, early 90s, when physicists, in particular Edward Witten, had this idea and tried to compute, in this case, in a space-time that is, was exactly as my kind of flatland example, a two-dimensional space and then a time direction, embed the knot as a trajectory of the particle. If you pick your field theory or your physical theory right, you can actually compute what is the probability that such a particle goes around, and what you get is a example of a knot invariant. In fact, you can even do it more carefully. You can look at the individual Feynman diagram, so you can think, for instance, send a quark around and have the quark interact by gluons, and it can be in many different ways. And these diagrams, then each of these diagrams would be an example of a knot invariant. And in fact, now there's a mathematical theorem, roughly, that all possible knot invariants are given by exactly these diagrams. So the physics intuition actually is able to solve this outstanding mathematical problem in a beautiful way. Let me give you a second example. It's even in some sense more elementary. It's really going down to the heart of mathematics, which is counting. Counting the integers, but just counting objects. And in fact, there is a field in geometry, which was very popular in the 19th century, called enumerative geometry, really counting objects, that in some sense disappeared because it wasn't thought to be very interesting, kind of recreational or something, but now revived completely. And in this case, you are interested in studying spaces. Again, spaces in very high dimensions. For instance, a space, this famous space, Calabi-Yau spaces, perhaps you have heard about them in other lectures. They are spaces which are have six dimensions, six real or three complex dimensions, and they're given by equations, complicated equations. But you see this is quite a beautiful equation, this equation down here, equation in five variables to the fifth power. It's called the quintic. And of course, it's very difficult to view it, and what you see here is something like a slice going through it. So it's, again, as I had this kind of hypercube rotating, and I think none of us saw the fourth dimension. I'm sure nobody here sees the sixth dimension. But it's somehow underlying there. And why? Well, there are two reasons, again, why people both in physics and mathematics are interested in this space. And let me give you an example. First, from the mathematical point of view. So here's, again, kind of an artist impression of that manifold. And what mathematicians were interested in doing is counting some object, namely counting curves. So a curve is really some kind of a curved object that you can put on this space. And these curves are labeled by an integer. It's called degree. I'll explain it in a moment. And then there is a thing called the Gromov of it, an invariant. It's a game where you compute an integer nd, you count the number of curves of a given degree. Now, this is a very hard mathematical problem. To show you how hard it is, the first number, n1, is counting the number of lines that you can draw on that space. Turns out to be there are 2,875 lines. Any algebraic geometer knows this number by heart. It's something that was computed in the 19th century. Famous result. Now, the next step would be compute n2. So n2, really big number, 609,250. It's the number of conics, so basically ellipses, circles, that you can draw on that manifold. So I think this was computed around 1980. And it's really a very complicated calculation, using all the modern techniques of mathematics. Now, the next one, n3, has a little story to it. So it's a really big number. And it was computed by mathematicians using some code, computer code. In fact, they computed it with this code, and because they were asked by physicists to do this. So they came with a number, and then they gave a number. And physicists said, are you sure this is the right number? Didn't you have a mistake? And they went back into the code. Indeed, there was a mistake. And they came with another number, namely this number. And the physicist said, right, that's very good. And so, of course, the question is, what did the physicists know? And in fact, what the physicists had was not only these three numbers. They had the whole list. And it's very difficult to explain, in some sense, the impact this has to a mathematician working in that field. Now, you feel this big mountain you have to climb. And every step is more and more heavy. And you think it will be somehow an exponential difficulty that you have to climb higher. And then somebody gives you the whole list at once. So clearly you're missing something. But what you were missing actually is very deep. And let me try to explain what. Of course, what they were missing in some sense, they were missing string theory. String theory is something that is in a very natural way a mechanism for many things, but in this case it's a mechanism to compute these numbers. Now, a string is some curve. Lying again, it could be, I will explain in a moment, moving on that space. And again, because of this principle of quantum mechanics, where you have to basically sum over everything at the same time, this thing is really moving around and it's kind of exploring all these possible different curves at the same time. So let me make this a little bit more precise. If you and you could ask, well, why on this crazy six-dimensional space? And the crazy six-dimensional space entered because these were exactly the spaces that physicists were interested in. And that goes back to another idea in physics, which is putting even more dimensions. So the first famous case is to add an extra dimension. It goes back to the 1920s, when Kaluza and Klein proposed this idea of having a fifth dimension which is very tiny and rolled up. So a fifth dimension that kind of goes around like a little circle. And if you do that, if you have a fifth dimension, you could have your particles moving not only in the usual three space and one time dimension, but also, say, basically go around this little circle. And they found if you have a particle that can go around to this extra circle, basically the speed by which it goes around is the electric charge that the particle has. So putting extra dimensions in a very natural way gave rise to a different force and to a different symmetry, namely the symmetry being the rotations around that circle. Now, this idea in string theory has been taken to really a next level by not only including a fifth dimension, but many dimensions up to 10. That is to say, this little circle gets replaced by a very complicated six-dimensional space, in particular a Calabi-Yau manifold. It's a solution of Einstein's equation. And so this funny space that was interesting for the mathematicians from just counting was also interesting for physics because it naturally appeared in string theory. And in fact, in string theory, we are interested in studying the movement of strings on that very complicated space. In fact, there's something which is almost, I think, belongs in a different department of this university, geometric engineering, where you basically take that space, this Calabi-Yau space, and you model it in such a way to get out, in some sense, the particles and forces that you need. So this kind of a dictionary where geometry is kind of put equal to the world of elementary particles, which is very different from geometry. So that's, again, one of these beautiful equal signs that appear in this field. Now, if you have such a string that moves around, so you can think of a string that moves actually a little circle, sweep out a surface, such a thing is called the Riemann surface, or it's also a thing, you can think of it as a so-called algebraic curve. And these strings will move in this Calabi-Yau manifold, and as I told you, they will not move at one fixed trajectory. What they do, they will move along all possible trajectories. And basically what happened is that these numbers here, these numbers that the mathematicians were computing, they were kind of elements in a single function that the physicists computed. So they had a unified object that included all possible lines, conics, cubics, you go on, in one big function that they could study. Now the second thing they did, so this is already a crazy idea from a math point of view. The second thing is even crazier, is that they didn't look at one particular space. They looked basically at all spaces. They made a plot of all possible Calabi-Yau manifolds. And you see, if you look at this plot, you see there's a very beautiful symmetry. It looks like for every manifold on the left-hand side, for every space on the left-hand side, there is a so-called mirror space on the right-hand side. These spaces couldn't be more different. If you were able to visualize them, they're very, very different. They seem to have no connection between them. But what physics is telling us is that if you consider string theory on these spaces, if you do quantum mechanics, then these two spaces become equal. In fact, in that way, you were able to compute these very complicated, so you have two manifolds, x and x tilde. In the classical world, completely different, unrelated. In the quantum world, certainly they are family. And you can compute what you want to compute on the left-hand side, for instance, these very difficult numbers. You could also compute on the right-hand side. I won't explain any of these mathematical symbols. But take it from me that the computation that was basically extremely difficult on the left-hand side became very easy on the right-hand side. So this was a circle of ideas, completely foreign to mathematical intuition, but extremely powerful. Now, the amazing thing is that all these ideas have now been proven. They are mathematical facts. In fact, some mathematicians won great prizes for establishing this. So what did they do? Did they actually follow the physical intuition and made it everything precise, all the crazy ideas? No, they did not. In order to prove these ideas, they basically used different techniques and a completely different route. In fact, I feel sometimes, you know, this is notion of complementarity, you know, like in quantum mechanics where it can either be a particle or a wave. Here it looks like there's some complementarity by rigorous mathematical thinking and physical intuition. In some sense, they not really go well together. In the physics intuition, is perfect to kind of have these pictures and to say, well, probably A equals B, but to prove it, usually mathematicians have to use very different tools. I think that's an interesting ingredient in this whole story. In fact, you can go much further. One thing you can do, we can, for instance, take two of these strings and they can collide together and make a third string. Now, this is, again, a beautiful geometry, but the nice thing is that in terms of the mathematics, it tells you that there is something else going on. Namely, if you have two objects, you can get a third. Now, this is, again, a very elementary thing in mathematics, namely multiplication. It really goes back to 2 times 3. So So what you are saying is, in some sense, in this world of string theory, so if you take two objects, A and B, something like A cross B is coming out. So there's a way to kind of multiply things in a very natural way. And that's a deep thing in the physical intuition, but it also gives rise to very surprising mathematical structures. And for instance, these are the things that right now in our workshop we are studying. Now, how natural is this way of making this world out of algebra, out of these funny pictures? In fact, to give an example, how you can change classical geometry. For instance, there's a very simple fact in classical geometry. If you have three planes, they will intersect in one point. And that's the way how you do geometry. Two planes will intersect in a line, and each pair of planes will intersect on a line, and then three lines will intersect in a point. Now, if you go in this quantum world, it's actually you have some kind of a different rules. For instance, these planes don't even need to touch anymore. In some sense, they intersect if there's something like a little string that connects them. So even the classical rules of geometry, even Euclidean geometry, if you wish, get changed and get modified. It's, of course, very striking that we think of all this quantum world as kind of funny and bizarre things that are very far away. But, of course, it's the real world that's quantum. It's us who think classically who are kind of the exceptions. So in some sense, our classical mathematics is only, if you wish, kind of a caricature of what real nature of the world is. And so the fact that actually even this kind of true nature of the world is beautiful also from a mathematical perspective, I think, is very satisfying. Now, I think at this point overloaded you a little bit, so I think it's good to relax with a little exercise. So the exercise I want to do is if you look at the screen, I show you something. So I hope you all seen it. So the question was, what's the triangle on top of the circle? Now, I'm told that there are two ways in people answer this. So one is that you immediately, if I say, is the triangle on top of the circle, you see a triangle on top of a circle, and you say, that's not the image I saw. Roughly half of the people think like this. The other one, they say, well, I remember the image, and I deconstruct it. So, well, I'll take the language in which it's described, and I analyze the language. So that's roughly whether I think you're using your right brain or your left side of your brain, whether you think kind of geometrical, visual, or you think algebraic, which is more like an algorithm. And it's, I think, very important that in mathematics you have both these two ways of thinking. In fact, if you teach a class, often you can be, some people, for instance, if you're lost, if you want to find the way, somebody say, oh, draw a little map. Now, roughly half the people are really helped by this map. The other half, they're completely flabbergasted. They really want to know first left, then right, then left. And they think linear in terms of an algorithm, like language. And so these two things are always, in some sense, also in math. I think there are two, or perhaps even more, ways of thinking in mathematics. But they're a little bit orthogonal. And in fact, these examples are, in some sense, quite interesting because they are in some sense, I would say, geometry is a typical visual way of thinking. I'm a visual person, so I've shown you many pictures. I know that for half of the audience, they only are more and more getting confused by all these pictures. There's also an algebraic way, but you more think in terms of putting things in as I say, like an algorithm, like a computer code, for instance. That's also beautiful in mathematics. You can do it step by step by step and make a proof, like a chess game. Now, one thing you can think of this. You could say, what is the dominant side of the brain, say, of the universe? Is it geometry or algebra? And clearly, people like Newton are very much thinking in terms of geometry, but I would say if you go to the quantum world, in some sense, it's more algebraic. And you can think that the whole idea of going to the quantum and doing quantization is kind of taking something out of the world of geometry, like, for instance, a knot, or a manifold, or a curve in a manifold. And translating it into something that is more algebraic, like these numbers. The probability that you have this funny knot. And in some sense, if you're here in the world of algebra, life is more easier in some sense. Because you can do all kind of tools, you can It's much more difficult to think of these flubby geometrical objects, because what is a knot if it's a figure? It's much nicer if it's a number. You can list them, you can order them, you can do all kind of stuff with them. So that's one part of the story. And you can ask, you know, what is, how should we actually now think about geometry from this algebra point of view? And in fact, that's something that has been going on the last couple of years in string theory physics, is that perhaps there's a way the other way around. Perhaps, you know, geometry is like our classical intuition, just something that comes from something that's underlying everything. And perhaps this algebra is even more elementary. So could it be that, like, for instance, all these little Feynman diagrams, that in some sense they can build up something that is really like a space? Perhaps space is not the starting point, it's more like an endpoint. There's something going the other direction. I think that's very interesting. It's a little bit speculative. But we have some examples in physics that does this. And I think finding the right mathematical language for this is extremely exciting. Now, in some sense, this is a very traditional way of thinking in physics. For instance, if you have a wave on the surface, certainly should mention waves here at Santa Barbara, you have beautiful mathematics, you know, the Navier-Stokes equations, beautiful mathematics describing the shape of the waves and how they propagate. Of course, if you look inside the wave, you see all these water molecules bumping, very complicated. You wouldn't want to study hydrodynamics in terms of the individual motions of H2O molecules. It would be very silly. In fact, the movements of the molecules give rise to this kind of emergent process of the waves. So could something like this happen? Could, for instance, Einstein, geometry, which he really thought was really fundamental, his dream to capture everything in terms of geometry, could it be an emergent property? Could it be something that comes out of equations? Now, there's one place where we have kind of, you can study that in a bit more detail, which is, in fact, a kind of very extreme case of geometries, which is the case of black holes. Now, probably you heard something about black holes. You know, black holes appear when you have enough matter, so much matter in the universe, in some sense, not only the space curves, but it kind of pinches off, a singularity gets formed. And in this kind of much more complicated string context, you can actually build these kind of black holes in a kind of complicated way by basically doing stuff inside this internal spaceship, this big space, this Calabi-Yau space. And if you put stuff in it, so-called D-brains, you can influence by changing the internal space, you can actually change the space-time that we see. The three-dimensional space that we feel gravity in. And in fact, in terms of a picture, if you add more and more stuff inside this internal space, the space-time will react to it, it will start to curve. And in some sense, what you can do is now you can study this geometry in terms of somehow the mathematics in this internal space. And that's a big program now in mathematics, and studying these properties and somehow seeing how geometry appears out of algebra. Now, I can't describe this in any detail, but there is some kind of a beautiful kind of circularity to the argument. Because you can ask, so what is then, if space is not the ultimate thing, what is underlying space? And what we seem to find, that what is underlying space, in all the examples, is at very short distances, space kind of disappears, and the mathematical structures that appear are structures that again belong to the realm of gate theories. The things that were really essential to the formulation of the standard model. So if symmetry, very big symmetry groups, in some sense, are, again, underlying the most fundamental thing. And that's, I would say, kind of in the spirit of Kepler. So if something like this would work out, I think it's lovely. But I think it's true that this is one of these cases where we are struggling to understand the equal sign. And we don't have yet the right mathematical language. Now, perhaps you've noticed that when I'm describing all this thing, I often use the word elegant or beautiful or something. And you know, it's very difficult to get this across because, of course, if you're describing mathematics without equations, as I say, you're always lying. It's like the cartoon version of a famous novel, right? So, and you can even ask, what is the kind of beauty that we're looking in mathematics? And I would say even there are kind of two schools of thought. One school of thought, I would say, basically like Kepler, trying to find the most special, the most exceptional object in the mathematical universe. And if it's that special, then it probably must be the one that describes our world. Another kind of nature is perhaps what, so this was this kind of intersection of all these Platonic solids. The other school of thought is, no, you should look more like general structures, like general logic. spaces, you know. Perhaps that you should be a little bit less specific and looking at structures. And I think these are, again, two different ways of thinking, and it's not clear yet which is the right way. And I think it's very exciting to see how things develop. What is the kind of mathematical structure? But I think both these kind of aesthetic feelings are very important in developing mathematics. In fact, there's another point of view, of course, which I should mention, is that, you know, as a physicist, the question is, how much should you be tempted by all this mathematics? It can be beautiful, but perhaps it's leading the ship of physics astray. And and of course, then it's very difficult to see, but if you look back in history, often you see that even what you think might have been the wrong way in a later period of time fall to place because, as I said, this unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. So in some sense, what I've been witnessing myself and I've seen the last, say, 20 years is that this, I think, interaction between mathematics and physics, I think it's probably one of the most intellectual stimulating developments in science altogether. It's basically one of the disciplines where you have a constant rate of return. Basically, every year we have seen a new breakthrough, and you know at some point it's really dizzying because you feel now we have now too many ways in which we can connect things together, and then there's again a young mathematician or physicist coming and say, well, there's yet another way in which we can think about this. And so it's extremely stimulating and intellectually challenging. You can also ask, you know, how should we place this? And perhaps, you know, in some sense, should hedge your bets. You know, but either this is, it's fun if it gives to beautiful mathematics, and it gives new theorems, and perhaps, you know, we can use it in physics in the very short term or in the long term. In fact, I want to end with an image. It's kind of a revamping of But Plato, of course, had this cave. Now, and what was the cave? Now, you had it was a dream world where you had perfect mathematical shapes. And these mathematical shapes projected shadows on the wall of the cave. And these shadows were our physical reality. It's very difficult to grasp these Platonic things. We could just see the shadows. Now, I think actually, in some sense, the role, this has been a case of role reversing. Because, you know, what we now have, I think, is what I would say the quantum cave. So we have now this physical dreams of a unified theory, dreams of extra dimension. Very difficult to extremely make them rigorous. But what they are doing, they're projecting very sharp shadows in the mathematical world. So all these kind of crazy ideas give rise to beautiful mathematics, very concrete equations that you can give to mathematicians. Say, well, I think these are the numbers. You go and check. You check, and then they go and prove. And they prove in a certain way, and they have to find perhaps a very roundabout way. And now there's this whole list of, it's basically like a wave going through mathematics. There are many mathematicians that originally were very skeptical about this, until this wave hit their field. And then they were immediately converted. Because, you know, if you have something like this magical formula that does everything for you at one stroke, you see this happening, it's actually quite shocking. So I think actually this is pointing also to something which I think is really perhaps the fundamental role that physics is doing for mathematics, namely it's putting it in a context. And that really goes back, I think, to the very beginning of my talk, that, you know, in some sense, mathematics, the equations always have to put in a context. So what are they good for? How can they be applied? And we see that can be happening in many, many different ways. And I think it's kind of very poetic in some sense that even the world of the very small and the very large are providing these new contexts for kind of old mathematics and are now able to prove people are using these intuitions and are proving great theorems. And I think this interaction between physics and mathematics is certainly part. Many people claim that we're now living in a golden age of mathematics. Great theorems are being proven everywhere. But I think this influx of physics is a very crucial ingredient. So in that sense, it's, I think, a very exciting time to live. And I was very happy to give you a little sharing a few of these ideas with you. Thank you.
Well, my introduction might have been intimidating, but I think we all agree that Robert lived up to And as usual, our audience, I'm sure, will live up with their questions. So the floor is open, and we have mic, which we will distribute. So don't talk until you get a mic.
You've probably been asked this question before, but there's a paper on the archive by Garrett Lisi, yeah. I think, that sort of gives another way to apparently beautiful mathematics,
yes.
But it doesn't involve string theory.
It involves E8, right? So it's precisely on this, right? yes.
Could you comment a little bit on that? At least let us in on what's going on there.
Well, I think I haven't looked at it in great detail, but what I understand is that in the physics there are lots of problems, you know, to make it precise, etc. And if you want to make it precise, you probably have to add many more stuff and. Before you know, you might end up in the kind of familiar territory. So I don't think at this point it's anything like an alternative. It is interesting, though, in some sense, you know, in this broad division between the two styles of mathematics. You know, it's this group he is using, the group E8. It's a close relative to this dodecahedron I've been using all the time. In fact, it's a symmetry group. There's a very beautiful pairing between the symmetry groups that appear in the particle models and, in fact, these platonic solids. And then E8 corresponds exactly to the dodecahedron. It's, in some sense, the most complicated symmetry group. It's, in fact, it's a crucial ingredient in string theory. So the idea that, in some sense, the group E8, and it contains, in a very elegant way, the standard model symmetry groups. So the idea that E8, this most exceptional fellow, is in some sense underlying our standard model is something that's very tempting. In fact, it was one of the original motivations, I think, of string theory. When David and others found E8 in string theory, it was really in that spirit. And recently also the people in string theory, Vaffa and collaborators, have been looking again at these exceptional groups. And so, in that sense, it's the occurrence of that particular symmetry group, it's very tempting. But whether it's a red herring or not, we don't know.
Since you were a self-confessed artist, I'd like to ask a why question.
Yes.
I appreciate that mathematics is unreasonably effective.
Yes.
Do you have any sense of why it's unreasonably effective?
Well, of course, I mean, the point is, there are many, many ideas about this. But one thing, of course, which is interesting is that you, it does have to do with the fact that, I mean, what is mathematics? You know, you can have all these platonic images because mathematics is what mathematicians do by definition. And, you know, this pi is nowhere to be found in nature, right? It's not that you have a big formula engraved in the wall of a canyon or something. So it's all that the human brain makes. So in some sense, you know, like you say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It could be that mathematics is in the eye of the beholder because that's the way our brain is organized. And so that's the part of nature that we see. Then you could say, okay, that in some sense that would explain why perhaps the things that we see around us are explained by mathematics, because that's our surroundings. They build our brain, and that's how we think, and it's just a very effective way to approach reality. Now, the amazing thing, of course, if you go to the size of the universe or to the size of a nucleus, that this is still working. So, and then you feel, well, perhaps there's a little bit more to it. Because there's no way in which our evolution shaped our brains to deal with quantum chromodynamics or an expanding universe or things. So there's something common to this, all these different layers in nature. And I think that's why, in some sense, many physicists feel that, you know, these very strong expressions that Galileo and Feynman and many others make, that somehow is very much in the heart of how nature works. And perhaps nature is mathematics in some sense. But then, of course, you might say, wait a moment, no, it's mathematics what mathematicians do, so it's really related to human beings. And so perhaps there are things out there which we should understand, not in terms of mathematics, but in other kind of other languages. So I think how even it's usually something only debated very late at night, and I don't think it's leading anywhere. But I don't think it has an easy answer. And this surprising thing, because you can say, well, it's in reasonable effectiveness, but when and where is this effectiveness happening? That's always a big surprise.
There is the experimental test, which I, as a Platonist,
yes.
I pose mathematicians and physicists, and mathematicians, I found, are sort of 50-50 divided. I'd be interested in your opinion. So the experimental test is, if we were to discover civilization across the galaxy, I mean, we know that they have the same physical laws.
Yeah.
We can measure spectra of atoms on other galaxies. Will they have the same mathematics?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. We haven't discovered, but would they? Some mathematicians have told me, no, they will have their own different mathematics. It's a human creation.
Mm-hmm.
I actually go one step further. I mean, I'm sure they all have exactly the same mathematics. Mathematics, mm-hmm. as you just showed, is nature, you know.
Yes.
But there's a more interesting variation of that once you answer the first one, which is, would they have the same history of mathematics?
Yeah.
So what is your answer to that?
Well, the certain parts of mathematics certainly are universal. I think it's very difficult to not have the integers. Because this famous saying by Kronecker that God created the integers, the rest is invention of math of humans, and well,
that's different.
Yeah, that's true. But well, I don't know. I think actually that almost all the mathematics that we know is in a very deep way connected to nature. So it's very difficult to study nature not being. For instance, one thing, of course, completely crazy is some sense that, you know, things like imaginary numbers, they were not called imaginary for a reason. You know, it's just something you think of, and then they actually appear in physics.
No, but there are some mathematicians who would argue today, something which I can't imagine. Namely, this civilization would have the same, you know, the spectra would be the same numbers, but their mathematics would be different and equally effective, perhaps.
Yeah. I would, yeah. Very difficult
anyway,
to say yes or no to this. Yes, yes. I'm undecided.
I want to question, you know, just raise the question of mathematics.
Yes.
The mathematical, the notion of mathematics, it seems that you employed it sort of classically, the notion of mathematics, and so forth, and we know that that's been disrupted. So
yes.
I wonder if you'd come.
Gödel's theorem.
Sorry, yeah, Gödel's theorem. So that's, of course, I think the brief answer is no. And of course, also, I mean, in some sense, Gödel's theorem is, of course, active in basically in a setting where, in some sense, the rule of the game are very precise. And then you can make a list of all possible theorems and they can briefly say which you can prove or not. And there are all these kind of then mathematical facts which are true, but you cannot prove. I think that's, for instance, number theory, of course, is typical the realm that has to deal with that theorem. I think in some sense, my feeling is that the kind of mathematics that certainly now is coming out of physics is much more, we're much more in the stage where we want to define the rules. Right? So in some sense, not yet that evolved as number theory that we might bump into statements like this. It's like we want to find the physical laws instead of studying all possible solutions. But I think at this moment, I don't know of any kind of really deep occurrence of Gödel's theorem in mathematical physics.
Actually, I was just handed a microphone, so
yes.
I'm permitted to comment.
Yes.
Actually, there's a beautiful consequence of Gödel's theorem in geometry.
Yes, of course.
Oh.
Yes. I was a part, yes. You can explain, yes.
So in high dimensions, there's a quite different phenomenon than in low dimensions. If you have, for instance, a bag, a wrinkled bag in this room, and you blow air into it, it'll become progressively less wrinkled until it becomes a balloon, until it becomes round. But it's a consequence, actually, of Gödel's theorem that this fact breaks down in higher dimensions. If you have a five-dimensional bag inside a six-dimensional room, and it's somewhat wrinkled, it may be that in order to straighten it out, it has to become vastly more wrinkled before it can then become round. So there's no, as far as I know, there's no understanding of this except through logic.
But that's related to the, in some sense, to the word problem, or?
It is related to the word problem. It turns out that you could use a procedure which systematically made the bag rounder and rounder to analyze the presentations of groups and decide which ones presented the trivial group at the end.
Has, to your knowledge, has anybody taken the mathematical reality in the quantum cave and tried to convert it to music?
Yeah, it would be very experimental, PSF. Well, be careful. I know at some point, you should ask Brian Green, because he has been doing very things with Calabi-Yau manifolds and strings, I know. But, I'll leave it to that.
I've always wondered about the issue of the universe actually being mathematical, or is our math just some sort of lame attempt to try to really describe what's happening in reality. But it seems like the ability of math and physics to be able to make predictions, very precise predictions, and then have those realized through experimentation would seem to lend more weight to the fact that we really have discovered that the universe is mathematical, mm-hmm. and that our math is just advancing and progressing in order to become better at describing that universe. Is that sort of what
one thing which is, I think, very striking is that indeed, if you look what are the places in physics where you somehow see the highest precision, both computations and measurements, it is in this world of elementary particles. So I think that's, if you really see something computed to the 12th decimal or something.
Yeah,
then
it seems very compelling that you really understand something about what's happening when you get that sort of predictive precision.
Yes. So, that's absolutely stunning. And that was also what I was stressing. So the fact that indeed, in some sense, I think if you really look at the greatest success, something of mathematics, applied in physics, certainly the standard model with all the rules should be a part of it, because it's not only conceptually true, but also in terms of actual computations and extremely precise computations.
A question from a non-mathematician who was shocked a couple of years ago to read about Gregory Chaitin's omega numbers, the suggestion that the Platonic idea that underlying what I'd understood about mathematical relations, that it would all theoretically hang together in an Olympian structure. Chaitin saying, based on what I understood of the lay interpretation of omega numbers, is essentially the regularity of mathematical relationship is essentially random. And did I understand the expression of what an omega number was, or Gregory Chaitin's concept, as essentially the structure behind mathematics, that it would all hang together in a Platonic realm of form, would be in fact nonsense in the notion that it was all random?
Well, I'm certainly not the person to comment on this, because this is an area of mathematics that's very far away from my own expertise. But I think the only thing I can say is that certainly if you shouldn't view as my presentation as being giving a universal talk about mathematics. Right? There are whole areas of mathematics that are not at this moment in this math-physics interchange. And in fact, these subtleties that you are mentioning, all the different kind of, also the ways in which all kind of the various kinds of infinities appear, etc. Mm-hmm. that's in some sense much higher evolved mathematics than the kind of math that I was talking about today. So I think it's certainly true that there are parts of mathematics which are not covered here. And these subtleties that you mentioned are part of that story. But I'm not the person to actually comment in detail.
So I don't quite know how to ask this question, but in my studies of physics when I was in school, I remember being very satisfied as we peeled apart the layers of the onion to get down to some very simple underlying theory, and that lots of complex physics can come out of simple ideas like a particle in a box or a complex electromagnetic phenomena building up things out of simple photons, and so it was always this this process of going from the complicated to something simple underlying. I tend to react sort of negatively to the string theory, mm-hmm. Because it seems like it's the deeper you go, the more complex these spaces and ideas become. So I guess I'm looking for your comment on, do you think there's some underlying simplicity, or are we going to end up with a very, very complicated explanation of these?
Well, but the first thing is that if you also, again, go in history, there were times that there were only a handful of elementary particles. Mm-hmm. And now I showed you this telephone book, full of all, they're all elementary particles or excitations. And I think there's some beautiful quote of Feynman somewhere where he says, you have this beautiful theory and then there's some experimental data and it kind of messes it up. And it gets, and then at some point you have to kind of give up. And it was just a dream that was, and then at some point, it becomes so messy that again, some structure appears. And then in the end, it's beautiful. And in fact, I think many people would now say that the standard model is more beautiful than electromagnetism, because it has these, in some sense, more elegant symmetry groups, etc. So it's in some sense, and it describes more, and in some sense, it's deeper math. So you have these transitions, you go basically tunnels from one world to another world, and sometimes you're in between, and it looks very complicated. So it's not fair to say that it becomes more and more simple. Of course, also what you do is that you package more things together. Now, I feel as to string theory, I think two things. One thing is that clearly we're not yet in the stage where everything clicks together and you have this beautiful structure. But so somewhere in between this tunneling process, if anything. And the other thing is, of course, from a mathematical point of view, it's really kind of breathtaking how things, indeed, the few pieces of the puzzle that click together, how they're able to do this. So you get just this sense, but it's a very personal answer. You get a sense of something being there, because it's how can it not be significant? But then you ask, what is, for instance, indeed the analog of the mathematics that would be underlying, and then you feel you're only seeing these little things. So I would say, in some sense, we have a very, it's like you, there are basically two ways to for instance, to describe also, for instance, space in mathematics. Like, think of the Earth. You can think of it as a globe that's there, it's a nice sphere. And you can think of an atlas with all these charts, and you have to go from one chart to the other, and you have to use all these different kind of points of view. I think we are very much now in that point of view, that stage of the development. So we have all these kind of points of perspective, and there are all kind of dictionaries, how to go from one to the other, and from the second to the third, while at the same time describing the same structure. But it's not like a overarching point of view. And sometimes you have to go out of the plane, in some sense, to see this. And I think that's still something that we're looking for. And whether this will appear, yes or no, because that's, again, a deep question of what is the nature of mathematics. Is there some one big equation or one concept that puts everything together? But this could happen. And we have lived through periods where similar things have happened. And certainly, there's some notion that nobody knew about, like a non-abelian gait symmetry or something. And then certainly, that's the right language to describe it. So in that sense, I have mixed feelings.
There's another point to be made here, which I think what is simple and what is complex is very time dependent. 100 years ago, matrices were extremely complicated. And Heisenberg, when he invented quantum mechanics, which sort of in the form of an equation involving matrices, didn't know what a matrix was. And Born and Jordan had to explain to him that these funny things, these square things he was dealing with were matrices. And now, of course, school children know what matrices are, right? On the SATs. So they're simple now. But 100 years ago, they were much too complex for a German PhD to have learned about. So simplicity and even beauty are time-dependent phenomena. They're acquired tastes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these things don't look beautiful at the beginning. It takes you a lot of work.
Like modern music.
Right. But then they really are beautiful.
I've been very impressed with the application of concepts of mathematical reality applied to biochemistry in the organization of amino acid groups and the production of the polymers of genes in the origin of life. And I think this is a very fruitful approach to the concept of how life actually started as a combination of these molecular species acting in the form of mathematical reality.
Well, I think you make an important point. So I think really, if you look at mathematics, there are various ways in which it can grow, just by internal dialogue. But also, I think it's usually very spectacular growth when it starts to kind of build an interface with another field of science. So biology, I think, would be a beautiful topic for another public talk, I think. Because also, I think there you can see a new mathematical concept developing. Although I must say that if you really look, what I think very special about what are we talking about today, is that this is not an interface where you have some mathematician who's interested in physics and a physicist who's interested in mathematics talking to each other. At some point, it's really the heart of physics talking to kind of the heart of mathematics. Now, some of these problems are in topology, or in number theory, or in geometry. They're something problems that really are seen as being classical and very deep inside mathematics. I think in the case of biology, I think perhaps this world, my own feeling is, it's still in the stage where people are struggling to find the right mathematical concepts. And I think it's a safe bet that new concept will be found and then will propagate through all of mathematics. I think so. Physics is something a little bit earlier in this, further in development because it had a longer history of interacting. But I think actually biology might have a similar course and perhaps even more spectacular.
Hey, in your Taoist view of math and physics, you show them to be complementary to each other.
Yes.
Do you believe it's possible that there exists a third element outside of those two realms that is the connection between the two of them?
Oh, there could be many points of view, but I think in some sense, it's very frustrating, certainly from physicists, of course, that they have this beautiful intuition and they in some sense hope that mathematicians clean up after them. But I think it's not the job of mathematicians to do the dirty dishes of physicists, right? So they then start and to invent their own ways. So your point of view, is there some way in which these two things could come together?
Yeah.
Perhaps at some point. But I find it striking that in basically all the cases where really big theorems have been proven that it turned out that the mathematicians brought in new ingredients. For instance, working in a number theoretical setting, something which is very foreign for physics, or using some kind of tools which are very unfamiliar, or sometimes just proving the fact without. Because I said one thing which is amazing is sometimes that you have these formulas A equals B, and that's in some sense the beauty of the story. And sometimes these theorems have been proven just by staying on basically continent A, just on one side of the equation. And so, which is in some sense less satisfying from a physics perspective because it's basically the link which we found so interesting. It's a fact, but the thing I take out of it that it's not necessarily that the physics intuition is the only way to understand this result. And in fact, I must say that one thing that is happening now, So certainly this field also has been propagating further and further mathematics. So I think now there's really the flow of ideas is also kind of reverting in the sense that now many physicists are learning very advanced mathematics. In fact, when you mentioned Heisenberg being intimidated by a matrix, I mean, spending these weeks here and learning all this very highbrow mathematics, I feel very much similar. So.
I have a question. So say you found your perfect mathematical theory. It was totally self-consistent and beautiful, and it described everything. Do you believe that that theory could exist without any real manifestation? Like it could exist in the Platonic world?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, what would be the ingredient to cause such a mathematical structure to become physical?
Now, that's a very deep philosophical question, right? So in some sense, you know, you can write the equation, but you can write Newton's equation, but it doesn't mean that, you know, a pendulum starts swinging, right? And right. What makes the pendulum start swinging? That's, well, I'm not a philosopher, so.
Too bad.
Into the equation. Exactly. Well, I think we've had both a wonderful lecture and a wonderful set of questions. Let's thank everyone. And there are refreshments in the comments.